Welcome back to episode 124 of Chess Journeys, Tales of Adult Improvement. Here on Chess Journeys, we love to talk about the glories of ratings gain and improvement, but oftentimes we delve into the plateaus and perhaps even the pits of despair below that. If you'd like to support the show, you can go to Patreon Chess Journeys, and I want to thank the Queen Level supporters, Tim Everett, Scott D4, B6 Joe, Matt Bush, Jay Garrison, Diana Rich Burgess, Brandon Hallside, Jeff Peterson, Tobias Rex, Bob Berger, Nicholas Harrigan, Rich Bradley Fenner, Fletcher Ray, Nathan Peterson, Christian Glaw, and the King Level supporter, Ian Samples. If you want to appear on the show, filling out the Google form in the show notes is a great way to do it. I actually have a lot of submissions. I've been going through them recently. So if you submitted yours months ago, just go ahead and resubmit it so it gets to like the top of the queue. So I know you still want to be on the show and you're still up for an interview. And if you're interested in improvement, which I feel like you probably are, you could check out Noel Studer's Next Level Training Program. You can use the code in the show notes to support the show. And if you're like, hey, I love this show, I just want to support it in some way, a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts is great. No one has written a review in months, so you'll be the only one people see when you write your hopefully good review. If you hate the show, you can just send me an email and tell me how bad it is. That'd be fine too. You don't have to write a review for that. All right. So we're going to bring in our guest today. We have Alex. He's an adult improver who is trying to achieve the impossible, get better at chess while wrangling small children. Alex, welcome to the show today. Have you had a chance to play any chess yet today?
Hi, Kevin. Thank you for having me on. I have managed to play a couple of rapid games this morning. It's the evening here, so it's a bit of a while ago, but yep. One win, one draw.
That's a good start to a day.
Not too bad.
Is that how you're able to start many of your days? Is like you get up and you carve out a little time for games in the morning?
Yeah, well, in the mornings, it will tend to be, I'll try and get a couple of rapid games, but my kind of main, I kind of track my progress now is more on the kind of the Lead Chess Classical, trying to play kind of at least 30 minutes. That's kind of what I try and take more seriously.
Do you play in any of the leagues on Lead Chess, or are you just clicking like the 30-0 button?
I think with the UK time, it's a bit hard to find people. That's something I would like to do, but yeah, at the moment I haven't really been able to fit it in, especially like we said, like with small kids, it's quite hard. But that would be something I'd like to do.
I agree. I found the leagues to be challenging for myself too. They seem amazing and they are amazing and people are very flexible. I'm just very inflexible, and so it made it challenging to find times. All right, so you play a little bit in the morning and you play at night. That sounds pretty great. Let's start with your backstory. Yeah. Did you play at all as a kid? Did you just start recently? What's your chess story look like?
So my dad taught me how the pieces moved, I think when I was kind of 12 or 13, and I think he beat me a couple of times, and I was pretty bad. And then nothing really happened after that. And then it was about... start of 2022, I kind of picked it up. It was around, I just felt like I wanted to do something new. I was obviously having small kids, there's not too many new hobbies I could pick up. So that was something. I think I just got a book. There was something on Amazon, not a book I've ever heard anybody talk about, actually. I think it was just how to improve your chess. There's a guy called Clive Key. So he introduced the basic tactics and kind of a basic opening repertoire. Got that all together and then started on chess.com.
Okay. So you thought you'd be interested in chess, and rather than just Google on YouTube chess, you were like, I need a book about chess.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, what inspired that? What made you think going for a book first?
I think I had it in my mind. I thought I was going to pick something up. I didn't quite know. It could have been, could have been poker or something else. But I saw that book, started reading it. And I didn't think, before I started reading, I didn't think I'm really going to get into chess. Mm. But I think I've got a bit of an OCD personality. And I think once I got into it, and you just kind of, you go on YouTube and you find everything that's out there. It kind of sucks you in. So I think if you do have that sort of personality, it's game over.
Okay. So you got your book that no one's ever heard of that seems to have set you up nicely. Where did you start on your chess journey? So you said you went to chess.com, you start playing some games. Where'd that first rating settle in at?
I was really, really bad. I think I was kind of went down to 300 rapid.
Okay.
But what I did most of the time at the start was to play daily games.
Okay.
So I think that's just when I kind of just got used to how it, the pieces moved and kind of just a bit of experience. Then it was probably a couple of months after then I really kind of started getting into rapid because you kind of, you start, well, listening to your podcast and the Perpetual Chess podcast. Nobody was playing daily. So I was kind of, I think once you get to that point, you think, well, I want to improve, you're going to have to at least be playing kind of, rapid,
Yeah. What
kind of
was the
target. I think
allure of starting with daily? Was it just kind of like endless time? You didn't
it's
feel the
just less
pressure?
scary.
Okay.
Yeah. I think because I think when I very first started, I mean, I'd be playing rapid and you get it's quite intense, I think, actually, when you first start doing it. So, yeah, I think it was just easier. And then you could practice your openings a bit easier that way as well. Even though God knows where I was doing that when I was, 300 rapid, but
Yeah,
yeah.
it's interesting. I hear a lot of people, they start with either bots or daily, just something that feels maybe a little more disconnected from their opponent somehow.
Yeah.
Okay. So you settle in at the glorious rating of, say, 300. What are your first steps? What did you decide? Like, did you get pretty serious pretty fast, or what did it start with just kind of like, yeah, this is a little fun thing to do while the kids are running around, they're crawling on me while
Yeah.
I'm, juggling two with one hand and clicking a button with another?
I think so. I mean, I don't think I stayed at 300 for too long. I think it kind of moved up, but I think the big thing for me, I knew I was really into it immediately. And listening to Perpetual Chess podcast, I think I discovered Chessable, which, yeah, that was just kind of still is a never ending. There's just so much that I kind of think it's so every couple of days something new comes out. So, but
Nice.
yeah, so I started with the Peter Giannatos book.
Okay.
Your first chess workbook, and I was doing that on just kind of spaced repetition for I think for a good 6 months. So that was just like every day, just doing that. But around shortly after,
That's such a
yeah.
great book to start with. How did you like that? Seems like that's one of the hardest things as new players have is like figuring out where to start. How'd you land on such an amazing book for a beginner?
So I think part of the thing that I find fun about, if I get really into something is studying about studying it or finding out, like going on all the going on all the forums and what's the best, I guess once you find Chessable, you go, what's the best Chessable course for beginners. And obviously that one I think everybody just raves about, get your basic tactics.
I
So
think you said something really interesting there that I think adults struggle with, which is like studying how to study, right? And it's
yeah.
like I hear all the time, like, don't study how to study, just study. And I'm like, but
Yeah.
it's really fun to study how to study.
Yeah. But no, I mean, I think at that point I had a list of all the books that I needed to go all the, I say all the way. I was never gonna, I'm not ever gonna go all the way, but you can see a path with all the courses that are on there, at least for the tactics side anyway.
Nice.
They've got it all the way up to the top. I think obviously like Woodpecker probably being the furthermost. So, but yeah,
Okay.
I mean, there's just so much stuff on there. It's
And
yeah,
so
never ending.
you said you did Giannato's book for like 6 months. What was your next tactics book?
So the tactics are that the one I'll probably just go back a step actually. At the same time, I was watching The Building Habits by. And actually, to be honest, I'm actually got my TV just to my left, and it was on earlier, The Building Habits by the Chess Bros. So that was just something that I just watched as like it was TV. So
Nice.
just kind of doing what they said at first according to my rating, and that was something that kind of shot me up quite, from maybe like 500 to 1,000.
Gotcha. So it's like thinking and building habits from them combined with studying some beginner tactics that's
Yeah.
able to get you up to about 1,000.
Yeah, and I think it was, I mean, the main thing is the focus on kind of what he's doing in the games, and a lot of it is control, having your pieces pointing at the center, and not doing anything too crazy, and then making threats once the lines have opened up. So, particularly under 1,000, there's going to be a tactic usually, or somebody's going to blunder if I don't do haven't done that first. So
Yeah,
yeah, that was
I did
kind of
enjoy watching a couple of episodes from that series just to kind of check it out. And I really liked how he was like, okay, so I could do this cool move, but we're not doing that. That's not the point of this. We're just building the foundational habits. So I'm going to do what I'm preaching here. And I thought that was really interesting that he was so intentional about like building those habits.
Yeah, and I think for like if there's somebody, there's people listening to this kind of like rated 500, 500 to 800, 1,000. I think that on YouTube, that's the best thing because I know there's a lot of people say, Naroditsky's really good and he is really good. And like Andras Toth, for me, the habits is something probably just a bit below that, which can kind of push you on the way to those guys.
Yeah,
So,
makes sense. It feels like with Naroditsky, he's so smooth that it gives the illusion, I think, that it's for like 500s. But I think a 500 walks away from it going like, I don't really know what I learned. Because I even have that myself sometimes where I'll watch him and he makes the game look so easy. And then I'm like, I can't replicate that though. Like, I don't know what my takeaway was here.
And I think sometimes, and what on his speed runs, it's kind of sometimes it's specific to the openings as well. A lot of it happens quite quickly, I find. Whereas on the habits, there's usually it's reasonably reserved. And again, like he's everything's pointing at the center. The whole premise of it is that you're making high percentage moves rather than doing the best moves. So, and then yeah, they'll usually be it will open up. There'll be a tactic or, he'll be able to finish the game, with an end game, pass pawn. So yeah, it's probably just a bit more simple, probably a bit more realistic for people with a lower rating.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I've been thinking about trying to get them on the podcast at some point to kind of talk about that. So I
That'd
think
be great, yeah.
another reminder that I should be doing that. All right, speaking about ending games and tactics, this week I played Young Forest in our tournament.
Oh, wow.
It's the league championship. And I thought he would play King's Indian, and I played what I thought was good against it, and things were going great until he found a tactic. And it was like I could see he was attacking my bishop with his rook. And I was like, cool, I'll back up my bishop with the queen. And then when the B file opens up, boom, I'm protected. I'm golden. And he was like, really? And he just takes the bishop with the rook. And I was like, what are you doing, man? My whole plan was to stop you from doing that. And then I see there's a four move tactic that wins a pawn. It was devastating. And then he played great afterwards. But that darn tactic, man, it got me.
So what do you, this is something I've because I listen to the podcast a lot and I don't necessarily hear people talk about these things, but we kind of train these, we more complex tactics, but how often do you actually see them in your games? I know it's something different to what I'm doing, online, but you're playing at a high level. I mean, do you often see a four move or even a three move tactic very often?
I think it depends on the theme. And I think that gets back again to why we sort of train on the common themes. If it's like a really, I'm going to use the word weird, but what I mean by weird is a theme I haven't studied a lot, I'm less likely to see it. If it's, something where it involves a pretty common type of sacrifice or a common situation like this wasn't that complicated where it was like a knight takes a pawn and has a discovered attack on a piece, which isn't that uncommon at all, but there was another tactic layered onto it, right? And so it's that thing of like when you can start chaining them together. And a great book I found from that was Chess Tactics from Scratch was this idea of like looking for those foundational points. And so sometimes I can find them, and like that one, I just missed it. Like, and the funny thing is, my coach, as soon as I moved the queen there, we went over the game, and he's like, "So you didn't see the tactic?" And I'm like, "Oh yeah, you see it, no problem, honey." He's like, "Of course, that is the whole position right now. There's only one thing happening in this position. Can this knight take the pawn? If it can, then you lose. If it can't, you're doing great." And the fact that you didn't acknowledge that is kind of problematic, right? If that's the only thing that's actually happening in the position.
Yeah, because I mean, I spend a lot of time doing tactics training. I was having kind of a bit of a crisis, thinking, well, how much do I see of these in my game? And I think a lot of the time doing the tactics, something that's helped me is just that board vision as well, when there's kind of a four mover, because then, you know, if it's multiple moves, there's often going to be different branches. You have to investigate the different branches that the reason why they don't work for the opponent. So I think that helps. But I always find in my games, when if I win, it will usually be through a tactic, but it will usually be for, I've put pressure, I'm creating threats and putting pressure on my opponent, and then they will make a mistake, which leads to a simple tactic. And that's what I find. I don't think I've ever seen a three move, you know, I've kind of mapped out a three move tactic that, I mean, I think I have, but, you know, like an impressive tactic that I've kind of seen in the books that I'm.
Yeah,
but I think there was one time I thought, oh, I've really got something, and it worked out. But actually, it could have been refuted if they'd bothered to calculate it. So,
yeah, I'd say that's what happens to me more often than not when I go for a cool tactic, is that I miss something and it's a blunder, right? Like, I think this is a cool tactic and I've gone next level, and they're like, "What if I make the most obvious move and just go here?" And I'm like, "Oh no, I didn't calculate that move." Yeah.
Those are usually exchange kind of sequences of exchanges, aren't they? I find a lot of the case, and usually they've been miscalculated. Actually, going back to one of your original, your question, with the next tactics book after that was Back to Basics by Dan Heisman. He's kind of coined the term counting, which is basically those exchange sequence tactics. So that was something that was good, and he's got a chess ball course coming out just for that type of tactic as well, coming out soon. So
okay, that'll be great.
That was good.
And is Back to Basics on Chessable?
It is, yeah.
Oh, okay, I didn't realize that. Okay.
And it's kind of it's kind of a step up from the Giannatos book. Nice. They're just that next step, because I think a lot of the people, there's the 1001. Chess exercises for beginners, but that actually is quite a big step up from Peter Giannatos. There's some basics in there, but there's some kind of complex, like say four or five movers in there as well. So
I find that a lot of the books that say for beginners are not for beginners, right? It's like we've labeled something else beginner.
I think a beginner is up to 1500 probably. I think that's kind of when people think intermediate is about 1500, I'd say.
Yeah, and I don't agree with that anymore. I think when I was coming up, that was definitely true. When I was 1000, I truly was a beginner. But I feel like beginners stops much earlier, because I feel like people are quite good at chess by the time they hit about 1000 now. They still don't have enough experience and board vision not to blunder and not to miss tactics, but like they know pretty decently well how to play. At least all the thousands I've played, it's kind of like me rooting for them to make a huge blunder as they continue making good moves, and I'm like, what is happening right now? I thought you were 1000. I thought like the rumor is you're not good at chess, but you clearly are good at chess.
Yeah, I think with everything, like, so there's people watching, you know, Naroditsky, you know, John Bartholomew, and, you know, a complete starters in the olden days just wouldn't have had that, would they? So, it's just a different time.
Yeah, I think so. Okay, so you've got the 1000 by working with the chess bras, with working with Peter Giannatos. After that, you're going to Back to the Basics. Is there anything else in there? Have you done any openings work yet? Are you just kind of going by the chess bras idea of, like, you know, get the center, develop your pieces, you don't really need opening theory?
Yeah, so as I was approaching 1,000, I got I started having coaching with Shivam, actually, which I got recommended off hearing that you did kind of among can't remember what episodes they were. It was a long time ago, but yeah, I
Yeah,
found
he's
him
a
out
great
and
coach.
tried to yeah had I was with him for about 5 months, I think it was.
Nice.
So I was doing some openings. I mean, I bought a few opening courses, which are basically were a waste of money at that point. So it was
Yeah.
the I think I've had some of your listeners. It's the my first open repertoire for White and Black. That stuff is just it's the same sort of thing. It's not for beginners, and it's not your first repertoire at all.
Yeah.
Because there was kind of like the Knight F6 Scandi, which is just
Oh.
unless you're, which is, I mean, I think it's a great opening once once you're a bit more advanced. But really, you just want to get your pieces out. I think I wasn't so on the on Chess Bra Habits. They like for White, they would do the kind of I call it like the baby the Italian. So you get your knight, you do your Italian, and then you put your knight on C3.
Okay.
But I just that was just a bit too boring. So Shivan kind of introduced me to like the C3 Italian.
Okay.
Yeah, but then I was yeah, then there was a kind of like a real basic course for White on like the French exchange and the Caro exchange, and I think and I learnt the Alapin just yeah, so it was the Alapin that was on Chess Bra. So I was kind of making my way through that, but
Okay.
slowly, like through maybe more so the last year, I'd been just getting bits and pieces of Chessable.
Gotcha. So it's like working on some openings a little bit around 1,000, but not like diving deep into like a really robust repertoire or something.
Yeah, and I still don't. I mean, I actually do spend because I mean, we'll talk about it a bit later. But join the Chess Dojo, and they're very much against that. Kind of even like further down. But what I do, I probably do spend a little bit of time every day doing openings. But I've got it on spaced repetition. But I've picked my openings so that they are really. You get your pieces out to move seven between move seven and 10, you get your pieces out, and then you do your control the center and your old Chess Bra Habits style. Because I kind of looked into things like the King's Indian, I even looked to the old Benoni, and there's kind of elaborate middle plans which I'm just not ever going to get unless I spend all my time doing the openings. So yeah, it's kind of play the Italian. Play E5. There's some good courses on Chessable for kind of there's the Andras Toth opening courses, and there's also the Midas Ratsma. So there's some club players ones on there. There's some and he's got a beginners one. So I've just kind of built my own thing from over a bunch of different courses. But I kind of do it. So there's a special my special technique is the you've got the lines before they start trailing off, so anything so and they're kind of like in a lighter shade, but anything dark up to move seven, I'll do that, and sometimes maybe move eight. So I don't really want anything any more than 10 lines for each. And I mean, the Sicilian takes a bit more, but say, like for the Caro, it's probably about 10 lines or so. Have that space repetition, and I kind of picked those openings purely for that. They kind of get your pieces out, and if you're slightly wrong, it's not the end of the world because they're reasonably, you're using common sense with them. So like the Panov attack and the kind of the French exchange, the Monte Carlo variation, which is a bit more kind of attacking, still doing the Alapin.
Yeah. And so are you working on like learning the plans as well, or is it more just like I'm gonna learn the first seven, eight moves, get my pieces out, and then you know what, I'll figure out the plan because I have the habits. I know I'm supposed to control the center. I know I'm supposed to sort of move forward in my thinking.
Is something that I think at the moment it's more just kind of playing normally because I think they're all kind of set up for that. But one of the things I'd like to do is get the model games. So I've kind of moved over from chess.com to Lee Chess. But what I like to do is maybe say, like, I'll find one of my games and then go onto the kind of the analysis board, and then I'll try and find a game played by strong players. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to start saving those and kind of see, you know, see what these guys are doing. One of the other things, I think it was Nate Solon, he was saying about playing against the computer, but just doing the move. So the computer is playing your opening, you make kind of common sense moves and see what they do, and then try and build a kind of like this model game, and then try to analyze it yourself. So that was something that kind of I was thinking about doing. But I mean, there's a million other things. So,
have you tried that yet?
I've tried that. I've kind of tried doing a model game, which was basically just a game that had already been played.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kind of flipped through that. So what I do is kind of set up these lead chess studies, kind of strong player games, kind of like, you know, like the Panov, or try and kind of get them all up to get in groups, so you can just kind of flick through them and maybe analyze them.
Yeah,
analyze them myself.
Sounds like a great idea. I've heard that advice from several people. I keep meaning to do it, and then every time I go to sit down, I don't know why I don't do it. It seems like such an obvious thing to do, to really understand not just the middle games, but like, what does the end game look like that you're shooting for? Like, are you often winning with a queenside majority, and you have like in the back of your mind, that's what we're playing to? I don't know why I haven't. It's kind of mystifying me now of why I haven't taken the time to do it. I think it's because it's hard, right? You have to really find these games. You have to kind of go through them and figure out which one does seem to be a model, which one was kind of just a random game.
And I think doing that as well, the other thing, I mean, I don't tend to get, well, I say I don't get too many end games. I do tend to lose. One of my weaknesses is allowing pass pawns through. But one of the things I think using that model is you can get a collection of endgame positions as well, and then you can spar those against the computer. So if you've got a collection of different openings that endgames that come out of the games, out of the openings that you've got, then that's something that you can spar as well. So,
so you said you lose a lot of end games. So, you know, as you're getting over 1,000, have you done any like rigorous end game study, or have you just kind of said like, hey, I don't get a lot of end games, it's not worth studying that
yet? Yeah, I think I'm reasonably proficient. So very early on the chess.com, they had a really good pawn, king and pawn end game video. So I wouldn't be able to explain it to anybody, but I can kind of intuitively know, I can do all the exercises. I got winning chess endings by, yes, that was one of my first courses that I bought, because I kind of like get on Chessable and you think, openings, end games and tactics.
Yeah.
So I've done most of the pawn end games on that as well. There's some tricky ones on there. And then more recently, since I've done the joined the dojo, there's Silman's end game.
Yeah.
So I've got more books and Chessable courses beyond my beyond my ability. So
yeah, it does sound like you have a lot of courses and books. So I guess that sort of brings me to my next question, which is like, how much time a day or week are you able to really carve out for this chess work?
I don't really keep track of the time, but it's one of those things. So like so in the morning when the kids are running around, so if I'm working at home, I'll have the phone out, you know, to kind of make their breakfast. And then as soon as I get a moment's peace, I'll be doing a tactic. So that'd be kind of like my, I would say it's got to be at least an hour and, you know, not including games. But that's mainly tactics and a bit of openings in there. And I should be, because I guess I'll have to tell the guys from Chess Dojo that I've been on here. So I should be analysing my games a lot more, but I haven't done that. And that's something, that's like the big thing that I need to make sure that I keep doing, because I can tell it does make a difference. And the mate and twos as well. Mm-hmm. If I slack off the mate and twos, I can really see it. Like my board vision is just not there.
Interesting. Okay. So let's talk about that real quick. So the Chess Dojo, of course, Jesse Cry, very famous for saying you need to analyze your games, and he's like for like hours. So I guess my question is, when you play these rapid games, do you look at them at all, or you just kind of move on to the next game? You have limited time. You're just doing the best you can to play as many games as you can.
It depends. So now, I mean, there are, sometimes I've gone through phases where I just kind of binged rapid games and not necessarily done that. But what I'm trying to do, so now I've gone onto the Lee Chess Classical. I'm saving all of those, making studies, and then commenting on them. And then I've also got the there's specific dojo games, which are at least 45 minutes. So there are people that I've met through the, or I've been kind of paired up with on the dojo. And we have post-mortems on those. And those are kind of like analyzed properly. So, yeah. And there was one of them because I graduated. What they do on the dojos, they do on like Twitch, or, and I think it goes on YouTube eventually. But Jesse will go through the games and he'll go through annotations. And yeah, he did mine. And it was just, yeah, the most surreal. It was a terrible game, actually. I was awful and I played too quickly. And he told me that, but yeah, seeing him, yeah, kind of commenting on my game was quite, it was really, really quite amazing. But,
that's interesting. So when you analyze your games, what's your process like? Like, how much time do you do? Do you use the engine in your process? Do you not use the engine?
If I'm really going through, we're not supposed to use the engine. I don't. And what I tend to do is I'll review it, try use it my thought process, and then I'll have my move that I think it should be, then I'll have a quick look to see if it's you know, complete rubbish or not.
Gotcha.
So I don't do it purely without the engine, I have to say.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, I'll put my comments in, and actually one of the things that Jesse said when he was reviewing my annotations was that I need to put variations in there. So that's something, you know, so what actually, I kind of comment on why my move was bad, but actually kind of comment on what, you know, what you should have done. So I think that's quite important. But I think one of the main things of like analyzing the games is kind of to actually just see, like, it was quite obvious I haven't been calculating in that move. It was kind of impulsive. And I think when you start realizing that, that's the sort of thing that kind of leaks into your, you become more aware of those sort of things. And that's kind of the, you know, just an easy way of improving.
So it sounds like it's not necessarily about even finding the best move afterwards. It's more about seeing that, like, you didn't calculate carefully and that's why you didn't find it, or even getting the practice of calculating to try when you're trying to find the best move when you're doing your analysis.
And also, and things like, you know, in the end game, like as soon as we get to an end game, I just don't stop and just kind of take it in, you know, what I should be doing. It's kind of, it just, the moves tend to be quite rash.
Gotcha.
So that's something I'm conscious that I do as well.
Yeah. I think that's something for me that after I read Shereshevsky's Endgame Strategy, I just understood how different of a game we were suddenly in. Right. And so I've like done a little bit better job of being like, okay, Kevin, it's an end game now. Just throw out everything you know about chess. About like having to develop fast and having to do this and figure out what is the plan for this specific scenario you're now in.
So that, so how I know you, because you got into that when you changed your openings, didn't you, to kind of more to the, was it the Caro and the Catalan?
Mm-hmm.
Do you, I mean, what was your level of kind of on the theoretical side? So were you kind of quite proficient? I guess the reason I'm asking this is it worth somebody like me doing that? Because I kind of got my basic pawn end games. I haven't really got my rook end games, like my Lucina and Philidor down yet. But do you think that you need to have that and also, you know, the other theoretical end games before you get into that? Or
I don't think so. I think as long as you understand things like opposition, which is basically the king and pawn stuff, that's about it. Like when I read it, I would have said, oh yeah, I know the Lucina position, and then you would have set it up and said, okay, solve it, and I wouldn't have been able to. So that's about where my rook and pawn endgame was. And I feel like Shereshevsky really helped me to sort of understand, like, when there's a bunch of nonsense happening, having some idea or some plan of how to approach it. Like, if it's just king and pawn, king, fine. If it's just a rook and pawn, you can kind of figure it out. But when it's like you each have a rook and four pawns and they're on different sides of the board, like I didn't even know where to start. It was just like, well, there's too much on the board, but there's too little on the board. Like, I don't know what I'm supposed to do. And I would just kind of be like, I guess I move my king to the middle. Like, that's the only thing I knew to do that made sense, or like put my rook on an open file and claim that I have something with it. And that book just really, I don't know, just seeing a bunch of end games be talked about. There's just some like subtle things that I learned that I couldn't even put into words, that just kind of like, I have a better feel for how end games work. I wouldn't claim to be good at them, but I would say I'm no longer instantly lost when I enter one. I just feel like I have some idea of maybe what could happen, and maybe the plan I come up with is wrong, but at least I've got like, I'm working towards something.
Yeah. I mean, do you feel you're calculating, because this is just kind of like thinking like, you know, what people are doing at higher levels, but do you feel like you're calculating long lines, or is it more kind of you can, I know I need to get my rook up here, I need to get the king in the center, and and I'd kind of figuring it out?
A combination. Like, I feel like with end games, there's a lot of concrete lines you have to calculate. But it just feels like there's also lots of fundamental ideas I'm working with. Like, okay, my goal here in this position is, if I can find a line that I calculate where I'm able to like infiltrate a bit with my king and use my rook to force their king back a little bit and have my rook more active, that is a line that I want to take. It's not always like, you know, calculating out to a win or something. It might be like, we each have a rook. I'm going to calculate a line where his rook looks passive now and mine looks active. And that's not always enough, but like in my mind, that might be the plan that I'm trying to work towards.
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely something, that I need to kind of get towards. But yeah, so on the dojo, what they tend to do is they'll give you spar, you know, positions to spar, and you can do that against the computer. So, yeah, that's something. But I've done the first three bits of Silman and a good chunk of the Yasser endgame. So, and I don't tend to get too many, but yeah, so I always notice if I lose, there's often somehow a pass pawn getting through the middle. Because a lot of the openings that I play tend to, you know, they'll have like, you know, open positions. So, you know, that does happen.
I'd say the biggest piece of endgame advice I can give to everyone is, if you have rook pawn ending where you have a rook and pawns and your opponent has a rook and pawns, that's a draw, like almost always. And so what I mean by that is like, just stay, if you're on the losing side of that, just stay alive. Just keep moving that rook around. Do not trade the rook. Once you trade the rook, if it was losing, it's lost. But if you have that rook, you know, you can always check that king. You know, you just be annoying. Yeah. Slide around the side, slide around in the back. And they're like, dude, just let me queen the pawn. And you're like, nope, check, check, check. That was one thing that my rook and pawn sort of study helped me understand, that like, if I could trade down to a rook and pawn endgame where I've been losing most of the game, it's no longer desperation. Now I just, you know, just hold on. Just hold on, and the odds are pretty good that you'll be able to.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've done some endgame work. With Silman, how far have you gotten? Are you going like the band by band?
Yeah, I'm doing it the day, because I'm not even sure what the rating is, because it's on Chessable as well now. As soon as I saw that, I was like, oh, yeah, I'll get it while it's on deal. But the first three sections. So I'm not even sure what that is, but it's kind of relative to my rating on or my rating band and the dojo. But it's kind of not, it wasn't really anything that I haven't done before. So, and I'm not at the rook end games yet.
Okay. Yeah, I really love Silman's endgame book, because it divides it up so neatly between like, this is what you should know at this level. I find that to be great. Okay. So you said you joined the dojo. I guess we should dive in. Why join the dojo? It sounds like you're gaining a bunch of rating points. Things seem to be going well for you. What made you think
it's... Well, I think, I'd kind of stagnated for quite a long period, because I think one of the, after I stopped with Shivam, I kind of the main reason that I did stop with Shivan was two things. Because one, I would have to meet with him during lunchtime at work, and then I was just so drained after it. I kind of struggled to do anything or kind of think straight.
Yeah,
because he was really good. And the other thing was that I felt that I just kind of wanted to do things my own way, because I think it got to the point where he was saying, you know, maybe do this course, do these openings, do that. And I thought,
yeah,
I'm just, because my time is limited, for me to kind of keep my enthusiasm, I kind of have to do it my own way and experiment a bit my own way. And I think, you know, I tried out different openings. I kind of tried out, there's a night, you know, the Reti and the Russian, well, the Petrov. And those just kind of weren't right for me. And I think once I started picking up kind of more kind of just normal mainline openings, I think things improved for me. But then I think joining the dojo was just a kind of that stability. But I think the main reason was kind of having that introduction to playing longer games. Yeah, so there's the structure, but kind of meeting, you know, doing the post-mortems and playing longer games, that's kind of going to take it through to the next level. And it's, you know, there's the element of accountability there as well.
Yeah.
So,
well, let's take a step back for a second, since you talked about coaching so much there. I think there was such a great lesson we learned there, which is that a coach can be great, and it just might not be the best fit for you. And I just think that's one of the really hard things it can be for someone who has a coach to like understand that, like, just because this isn't working for you is not a reflection on that coach. That coach can be truly fantastic. It might be a personality thing. It might be a play style thing. It might just simply be a time zone thing of not being able to meet up in a place where you can be your best self. And I think that's really important that you can kind of acknowledge that and just say, like, you know, I'm going to have to go another direction, even though I can acknowledge you're great. This is not a criticism of you.
Yeah, no, I definitely recommend Shivam. And I think, I mean, I'm quite happy with the dojo. But I think getting a coach to review your games regularly is going to make a massive difference. It's something that I'm probably kind of not really, it's not suitable for me right now, but I think, you know, maybe down the line, that could, I think, especially for like kind of, because I'm not playing OTB. The plan is to kind of join a club maybe next year. I've kind of located a club, so I think, you know, if I can kind of push on and get to the next step, then I think that could be useful.
And what's stopping you from going OTB?
Children.
So it's just simply how time consuming it is to have children.
Yeah, like kind of getting out in the evening. But it was quite interesting also, because I'm not sure how seriously kind of my wife was taking it. But when she saw the video of Jesse talking about my games, I think that kind of made her go, well, you know, he's actually doing something. There's something going on here. So
that's cool.
Yeah, so hopefully joining a club next year, that's kind of, you know, what the next, I think, you know, because ultimately what we're kind of doing it for, because it's quite a lot of time, you know. It's something that I don't even have to think about doing, because I'll put in over an hour a day, but none of that is kind of effort really. It's just it's just kind of something I enjoy doing. But when you actually kind of stop and think about, you know, what we're actually doing it for, I think, you know, playing OTB, kind of getting out there, meeting people that are doing it, you know, doing it as well in person, I think that's kind of where you got to get to.
Yeah,
or at least in my mind.
Europe has those amazing leagues you can join. I'm so jealous.
I looked at the website. So they were taught, so this club does that. It does look quite intimidating, I have to say. It does seem very serious, but I think that does that. And I think their fee day rate, there's mention of it being fee day rated as well.
Yeah, I don't know. I know there's the, like, I think it's ECF is the English Chess Federation rating, but they might be FIDE as well.
Yeah. So, yeah, they seem to have access to FIDE rated points. So that would be interesting. But, yeah, so I'm going to have to get down there at some point.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I look forward to hearing about your over-the-board journeys, because it's always interesting when I talk to my guests and they start playing over the board, because it's this weird thing of like, for a lot of people, not everyone, of course, it makes online chess feel slightly lesser than somehow, right? It's kind of like, yeah. Oh, now that I've held the piece in my hand and stared my enemy in the eyes, something is different about online chess where I just don't have that visceral feeling.
Yeah. I think just in person is just so much more severe, isn't it? When you think about everything that you have to go through, and obviously that you're playing longer time controls as well. So that's that in itself is just, you're playing more, you know, you're going to be calculating more. You're just doing more, aren't you?
I think that plays a part as well. Psychologically much more demanding, at least for myself. Like this game against this youngster this week, like I was pumped to play him, right? I was preparing to play him. I drove to the place. I thought I was playing well. And then when he got the tactic, it was like a knife in my heart, right? It was like I wanted to just like fall out of my chair, because I could see it now coming, right? After he takes my bishop with his rook, now I'm looking for it and I see it. It's gut-wrenching and there's no way out of it. And I know now that means then I have to play for like another hour and a half, losing the whole time and clawing and fighting just to try to turn it around and hope he makes a mistake. And like, I don't know, there's something about having it being online. I could just kind of write it off and be like, oh, well, that happens sometimes. Like, it's annoying, but it just felt so, so painful. And it was very hard for me to be like, all right, get it together, man. It's just a pawn. He's not a robot. He's just an 11-year-old who could make a mistake. Didn't and crushed me, but still, you know, I tried to keep my head on straight.
So is that tournament still ongoing then? Because you said you were doing quite well, weren't you?
Yeah, so it's a 6-round event. There is one more round left. I am 3.5 out of 5. If I win my next round, I will almost certainly win the trophy for my section of under 1700. So we'll see what happens. I mean, I had been doing well, but then, you know, Forrest derailed my success train, we'll say. But he's 5-0 now. He's 1800. This kid might go over 2000 from this event. This kid's ascension has been really remarkable. In a year and a half, go from like 1000 to 2000. I would do a lot of things to pull that off, Alex.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at his age, I guess he's on track to become master then, you think?
I would think so. If he doesn't achieve master, I'd be pretty surprised. I think it kind of depends on him. You know, it's like he'll be entering the teenage years, you know, that journey from 2000 to master is much harder. You know, like, I don't know what his life story is like how hard his journey to 2000 has been. So we'll just have to see. I know I'll be rooting for him. He's a good kid. So
yeah,
see what happens. All right. Let's go back to the chess dojo then. So you said you joined because you were looking for some sort of program. You were stagnating a bit. You liked the accountability. Has that accountability built into the program really motivated? Has it caused you to do more? How has that worked for you?
I think the main thing that I've got out of it is the longer game. So I've kind of, there's a couple of people, you know, that I've played through there, and just that, you know, that post-mortem, it's kind of like a bit of a, that has an impact, just that you're playing games where you're kind of just stopping and looking a bit longer rather than kind of, you know, like a 15-10 or, you know, a 10-minute game. It's just a different experience. So I think just doing that, and then you're forced to kind of, I say you're forced, but you know, you're supposed to analyze them. You playing those longer ones, they're just a bit more serious, and then you kind of just dig into them more than you would if it was just kind of like a short, you know, short 10-minute, 15-minute game that you're playing, you know, like I say, like those ones I play in the morning before I, you know, get to work. But so that's the main thing. And you know, people joke about it, but those mate and twos, we could go back to kind of my tactics training, but I was one of these people who did the kind of the spaced repetition, and I still think that's a really good idea, especially kind of like some of the kind of the three move and four movers, where I was kind of practicing you know, doing the different the kind of the different branches. But what I do struggle is once I got really good, or I could just do them secondhand, also just kind of like off the back of my hand, I'm not thinking as much, and I could see that my thinking in the game, my games would just be, my board vision would go, I'd be making more blunders. So I think having those, I think you do need to do a bit of space repetition, but those kind of having a puzzle that you just sit and look at for 5 minutes or however long, I think that's really important. And like just getting back, doing those main twos, which I don't know, you know, haven't done them before, I think really does make a difference.
Yeah, it sounds like you're doing something similar to what I'm doing, which is where you have like your tactic work. And then it sounds like for you, the mate and twos are almost like calculation puzzles because they are challenging enough. It's taking you a while. Do you set them up on a board, or are you looking at them in the book?
I just look them in the book. Okay. Visualization, yeah.
Yeah, I have my calculation book called The Best Move, and I set them up on a board. And I have noticed lately I'm doing better. I'm getting more and more of the right answers, but not always through calculation. It's just kind of intuition. It's like, who's better and why? And I'll be like, black's better. Now, why? Ooh, I think this is the line. And the book will be like, that's not the line at all. They were better. You were right, but this is actually the line.
Like, okay. So I'm always interested to, because again, this is not something I hear on the podcast too much, but how people train their tactics. In like, say, like, you know, you, because that's a really hard book, isn't it? I know the Dojo recommend that at kind of a very high level.
Yeah.
How, if you get something wrong, do you revisit it shortly after, or do you just kind of just go through the book and then you just start again?
I don't even start again. This book, I'm going to go through it once and move on, because to me, that book is not about memorizing any particular positions or answers. It's more about the struggle of taking a challenging position, not always with an obvious answer, and grappling with it. And in the process of grappling, I am working on my calculation abilities. I'm working on, if nothing else, my willingness to do it. So that when I get in a game and you feel that tug on your brain, go, let's just move a piece, man. Like, just stop already. Like, this is too much. You've sort of practiced fighting that, and you're like, no, brain, we're going to work this out. Whether you're against me or with me, we are going to continue thinking about this. So it'd be great if you could just get on the right page here.
Yeah. And it is a different muscle than just kind of churning through simple tactics as well, isn't it?
Yeah. I feel like simple tactics are much more about like that really important skill of pattern recognition and seeing something quickly, which then allows you, when you are going deeper into something, to rule things out immediately or look at things and pretty quickly be able to calculate lines and branches because you've seen that pattern, or maybe there's a piece of that pattern there and you're like, ooh, this is kind of pulling me in. I think there's something here. I don't, that pattern I memorized, that's not here, but it's similar-ish. And now I'm looking in that direction. That's kind of how I think of like the basic tactics. I think they're incredibly useful in training, but I personally have gotten to where I know my own struggle is with telling my brain that it has to stay engaged and we shouldn't just make that move that looks fine, because that's what my brain wants to do. It wants to spend like 2 minutes max and then say, hey, that's fine, I don't know what your problem is, why are you so picky here, just make that move, it's fine.
So
have you done any of the sparring? That's one of the things I found most interesting with the dojo, is like finding these end game positions and knowing that you have people that are also looking to spar them with you.
I haven't found anybody to spar. I have done against the computer though. So, which is, I think you're allowed to do that in end games. I think the middle, there's certain other things that you've got to, I think that was on the lower cohort, that you're supposed to do like a position, like you'd be up a queen and then you've got to convert. But I think I think my cohort now, that's not on there, so I never got around to doing that. But then I always thought, I guess, again, it'd be cheat. Well, would it be cheating? Because there's the Maya bot in Lee Chess, and I think they are pretty realistic. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't notice that it's not a bot. So I think you know, possibly doing those if you can't find somebody would be quite a good idea.
Okay, and so the Maya bot is that bot that sort of trained to not play like Stockfish at its best and then occasionally make an error, but it's like trying to replicate someone of a certain level.
Yeah, I think they've just got a load of games like from at a certain level of rating bands, and they've just kind of melded them in into this bot. So I don't play it too much. Sometimes what I used to do when I was like really like I was just didn't have any board vision, I'd play against the Maya bot just to practice my thought process. Just stop and try and, you know, what does this move do? Checks, captures, and threats, and all of that, and just try and train that in some sort of game simulation. You know, kind of guess game situation. When I kind of really noticed I just wasn't stopping and looking. So I think that sometimes that's quite a good thing to do.
And why play against the bot to do that? Is it so you don't feel the time pressure and you can really slow down and work through that process? Or is it more of like you just didn't want the pressure of playing a person?
Yeah, I think it was just that I could put it on a 60 minute time control, and then I could just take my time and do it.
Right. And it's a 60 minute time control where it's all you. And you don't have to wait for someone for half the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
You can make them go fast if you want to.
Yeah. Okay. That's cool.
That's not something I've done regularly. But one thing that's actually really interested me, though, was somebody you had Aiden on. I think it was back at the start of the year, like that visualization.
Mm-hmm.
What he was kind of talking about. And that's something that I think that if you spent the time doing, I think that could make a big difference. I don't know if it was something that ever kind of piqued your interest in the end, but I quite like what I do sometimes when I'm just not doing anything. I'm trying to kind of map out the board at the moment because there's lots of different patterns. There's kind of like, there's like a, I mean, I won't go into it now, but I think you can kind of map out the different shapes on the board, and I'm starting to see them in my head, and then start doing like a few kind of simple puzzles, and then eventually get to the point where you can do that game. And I think potentially that could make a big difference. But again, it's just another thing on top of everything else.
When you say you're able to start seeing the patterns, do you mean like you literally see the board and you can see the patterns moving on the board?
There's like on like the bottom corner, there's like an X-wing, and then there's like two, there's the kind of an X-wing of the black, so the black on the kind of the top right.
Yeah.
And then there's a cross, and then there's two arrow, there's kind of these two sections.
Nice.
And then so like the arrow, you know, if it's the X-wing's at the top, the arrow underneath will be pointing into the X-wing. And then you can figure it all out from that. And then they all kind of correlate to each other, and you can figure that out. So that's something that's actually quite interested me. So
is that on the Don't Move Until You See It website? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, that's something I've seen elsewhere, but it made sense to me. And because they were saying that, well, actually after he was on, I just kind of started looking at different visualization bits and bobs on YouTube.
Gotcha.
And something that like that came up, but they were saying that, you know, once you actually start knowing the colors, you can start to see it in your head. I know, you know, certain people can't, but I think I am somebody who's quite visual. So that I started doing that, and I thought, well, actually this seems to be working. So if I'm putting my daughter to bed and I'll just be sitting there, I'll start doing, you know, trying to go from, you know, the bottom left, you know, I'll pick two squares and I have to try and find where the intersecting square is. And it does seem to work.
That's cool.
Yeah, we'll see where that goes.
Yeah. It's something that I've really struggled with myself as someone who has aphantasia and can't actually see the board. I do some of those sort of exercises, but I think I do them weirdly where it's like, I'm like, I don't know.
It's logical,
like, it's like a story I have to build about the board rather than, since I can't see it, right? It's like, all right, the bottom right is a light square. So if I move over two and up one, that's going to be a dark square because two over is a light and one up is a dark. Yeah. It's a very like thoughtful process. I can't just like, bloop, you know, just immediately have it flash in my head like that's a light square. So I'm really trying to wrestle with like, do I try to get around that by just memorizing where all the squares are so that when I tell that story, I can just and like populate with words, even though I can't populate with images, or if I just kind of say, like, you know what, that part's just not a realistic area for me to explore, and I need to make up for that weakness through other strengths. So since I can see the board when I play, I don't have to play blindfold.
Yeah, I think there'll be a way of doing it. It's just kind of like a logical process, but it's just something I guess you figure out what works for you. But I think I buy into that kind of what he's saying. Just like when you can, because I don't think it's a case that you'll just close your eyes and you see the moves and just kind of start moving the pieces around. I think it's just you get that flash of insight that you can kind of see. Because I know even just when I started doing more complex puzzles and just visualizing the different kind of variations, that made a difference in what I saw on the board. So kind of doing something like that, I think could really just improve your board vision.
Yeah, it's something I'd like to improve on. I think there's also a part of me that probably has an unrealistic idea of what regular people see. Like I imagine people like seeing a perfect chessboard in their mind when they close their eyes and easily manipulating it like it's a video game. And probably that's not even close to what's happening. So, or maybe it is, I don't know.
Yeah, I didn't get the impression when he was talking about it, because he referred to his conceptualization, because I think he even said, like, you know, the kind of the masters, they don't necessarily see it. There's different kind of modes, isn't there? Like audio and visual and logic and,
All right, Alex. Well, this has been a fantastic conversation. It's really cool to talk to somebody who is sort of earlier on their journey, has two kids, is trying to juggle it all, making some time to do it. I guess where I want to leave us with is one final question of, like, what kind of goals do you have? Like, do you have any short and long-term goals that you're working towards? Or is your goal just, you know, keep putting in the time and enjoying the process?
Well, I think ultimately, I mean, I want to start playing over the board. I don't have any grand plans for that. My main plan is that at some point that I have a bunch of friends that I can get the chessboard out, go down the pub or go for a coffee, and I have a group of people that, you know, I can do that with and continue to study. Because I think, you know, it's just something you can study for the rest of your life. So continue to improve from that book. And then finally, like from a ratings point of view, like online, I think if I could get 2000 on chess.com, I think that would be very good, you know, down the line.
What are you at right now?
I think it's achievable. So I'm like my Lee Chess Classical is my main one now. And that, I think that's 1601.
Okay.
So, modest, but I think from where I started, it's been quite a big improvement for somebody who was absolutely no natural talent. So
that is a pretty amazing improvement. So you're about 1600 now, hoping to get to 2000. That sounds doable to me.
Yeah. Well, 2000 chess dot, cause I don't know what is on Lee Chess. So maybe that's 2200, but yeah, so yeah, 2000 chess.com. But yeah, I mean, if I could get some like over the boards, I think eventually that will be kind of the ultimate goal. And if I could get, you know, somewhere half decent on there that I can have a good game, then I'll be happy.
Okay, that sounds good. Yeah. Well, I look forward to hearing the updates of your journey when you make it over the board for your first tournament. Make sure you reach out and stay in contact. I can't wait to hear you join the English League and dominate it. It's going to be amazing.
We'll see, but yeah, I'll let you know for sure.
All right, well, thanks so much, Alex. And for everyone else out there, I hope this is that week where you have all your improvement and everything is great. And if it's not, and it's a regular week and you're just plateauing, or even worse, you're losing all your rating points, don't worry. Come back next week. We'll have another guest to help you along your way. And I'll see you next time. Goodbye, everybody.